Healthcare workers have been among the first people in England and Wales to receive a third COVID booster jab. The mother of a young boy with breathing problems has won her legal case against the regulation of a landfill site she said was emitting noxious gases. BBC News.
And the news was read by Jane Steele.
So what do people do for fun around here, she asked.
On BBC Radio 4, the new novel by Sally Rooney.
Are you shy? He said. You tell me. They looked at one another. I think he might be, he said.
Desire.
She blushed visibly at his remark.
Friendship.
We are best friends. So how come it took you all this time to come visit her?
Beautiful World, Where Are You? By Sally Rooney. Next Monday to Friday evening at 10:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
But now the doctor and comedian Phil Hammond concludes his journey around the country at the Worcestershire Royal Hospital, revealing the funny, frank and sometimes poignant stories of day-to-day life in the NHS in Dr. Phil's Bedside Manner.
Gorgeous, lovely people of Worcestershire Royal Hospital, please, pop your pants down halfway. Turn onto your left-hand side, draw your knees up to your chest, take a deep breath and prepare to be healed by Dr. Phil! Thank you, thank you, thank you. Well, welcome to Dr. Phil's Bedside Manor. This is a show where I wander around the NHS, sort of taking the temperature, but also listening to people's stories, nicking them for my comedy shows, and then in return trying to entertain you. And boy, have I had a lovely time here. You have the most fabulous hospital, so give yourselves a huge round of applause.
I'm Wendy, Jo Burns-Harris, Director of Ops for Urgent Care at Worcester Acute.
And what does that involve?
Okay, it's day-to-day operations. It could be restock of water for the patients, or the next minute it could be that we've got capacity issues at the front door, we've got doctor shortages. It's the day-to-day running of the division, really.
What attracted you to the staying in the NHS?
I was absolutely adamant I wasn't going to stay, actually. Right. I can remember that conversation really well. I can remember saying, why have you all been here years? I won't be staying like you lot. I shall be off. And I was sort of like 21. I remember it was in wheelchair services. And I can remember that moment of the impact of an eight-year-old child. And it's still some stories always stick with you, who couldn't leave a house because I hadn't got a wheelchair. And that, for me, was how important it was.
Yeah, that's interesting because you're sort of tearing up there.
Yeah, I am.
And we always talk about the NHS, about doctors and nurses, but we don't talk about the complexity of gluing it all together and the whole patient pathway and how little things like that can make all the difference. And is that
Isn't it your strength? Well, I think 21 years later, the fact that I'm sat here and you can't see on radio, tearing up about it, remembering the impact on that family of not being able to take their child out on a day trip because they hadn't got their electronic wheelchair ready, still this with me now. You know, so it is understanding that no matter what level you are in the NHS, it's so important that you do your bit. So processing that paperwork, getting that letter out to that family. And I can remember the day that that chair was ready and then they came in to have it adjusted. It was just great. It was just a really good feeling. I think that was, for me, the moment that I was hooked.
So if you could talk to your 21-year-old self who was saying, no, I'm not going to stay around here for long, what would you say?
I'd say, you gobby cocky... young thing, I was going to say something else then. You need to rein it in a bit and understand how lucky you are to be in this job. I think I'm incredibly privileged to be in this position and to do this job, actually.
So I'm Mike McCabe, I'm one of the consultant anaesthetists here.
So my slight antipodean antennae go up when I hear your accent. Can't quite place it. Is it Australian or Kiwi or a bit of both?
It is a bit of both. Mum Australian, Dad a Kiwi.
Now, the first thing I should have asked you is, what do you like to be called? Mike or Michael or something else? Because that's a really important part of your life, isn't it?
It is. Am I in trouble?
No, but do you like... Oh, your mum calls you Michael when you're in trouble.
Absolutely.
Yeah, my mum calls me Philip.
Yeah, quite often for kids, isn't it, that they call formally by that formal name or they're in trouble. So, yeah, I'm a Mike.
So as well as being an anaesthetist, you got this idea of finding out what patients prefer to be called by as being really important in their journey through the hospital. Where did that idea come from?
I had a clinical interaction where a patient was living a life as a different sex, but the hospital clearly had their birth sex and their birth name, and they were forced to wear that on their badge. That was on all the hospital electronic systems. And so the hospital system didn't have anything to allow for this. Yeah. Roughly a third of patients who come to hospital like to be known by a different name to their former...
A third? Why did you pluck that out of the air? What research has that come from?
That's come from Western Australian study.
Okay.
But there's not much published about it, no. So yeah, people who want to be known by their middle name, their abbreviation, the Bettys and Elizabeth, but you've also got the older generation that like to be known as Mr. or Mrs. or the Reverend, the Colonel, you know, all these things. But in a hospital, in the NHS, we all make the assumption that what's on your sticker, your first name, is what we're going to call you.
So how did you go about sorting this out?
So, simple solution is really, is on the wristband, we ask patients when they come in and when they're processed, what would you like to be known as? How would you like to be addressed? And on the sticker, which the patient's wearing, we put what they like to be addressed. Might be Dr. Hammond, might be Her Majesty, might be Elizabeth, might be Betty.
Might be Philip.
Might be Philip, yeah.
My first day as a junior doctor, I worked at French A Hospital in Bristol, and my surgeon was Mr. May. And I'd been out for a curry the night before, had a fairly juicy old Rogan Gosh and a couple of beers, and I was feeling a bit dodgy, didn't think I'd be needed in theatre. And he invites me in because he's removing an appendix. And I have to hold under some piece of equipment. It's really hot in there. And then about halfway through, out from me slips the most unpleasant, silent but deadly fart I've ever done. You know a really bad curry fart. You must know that. An absolute shocker. The bloody scrub nurse goes, I smell feces. Sister goes, I smell feces too. Mr. May says, damn, I must have perforated the bowel. I'll have to open him up. What is poor old Dr. Phil to do? Do I put my hand up and say, excuse me, sir, I made that heinous smell in your operating field. Can I have my reference now, please? Do I stay silent and watch this poor sod open up like a zip while they search for the non-existent hole in his bowel? Well, fortunately, I've always had the gift of the gab. I came up with the third way. I leant forward very quietly and I said to Mr. May, I think it was sister. Thank you, thank you. If in doubt, blame it on the nurses. Although, as I say, if you do blame it on the nurses, they come back to haunt you then.
My name's Dave Southall, I'm the chaplain here.
How long have you been here, David? How long have you
been here? 12 years. I've been a minister for 20 years. I've been a community psychiatric nurse before that. Worked on long-stay mental health wards before that.
So religion is one strand, but you also like dressing up in your leathers and biking, and you have other coping mechanisms as well, I understand. Tell us about those.
I don't like dressing, it's a necessity. But,
yeah, it is. Obviously, you need to protect your elbows when you fall off. But
it's great, Craig, because no one expects a vicar to come up and, you know, in their in their leathers. I tell you about a funeral recently I did. They were obviously a family, you know, who couldn't afford to pay for a funeral. Funerals are expensive.
They're expensive, aren't they?
Huge.
I'd be happy to be thrown in the ground in a bin bag or a compostable. I don't want any of that.
Yeah,
of course.
And so I turned up there, and there was a chap I got out of the corner of my eye in a pinstripe suit. I thought, he doesn't look very family. And he came up to me and he said, oh, I've been asked to blow the family in. And I thought, that's not a sentence that I often hear at a funeral.
I've been asked to blow the family,
blow the family in.
Right, and did you keep a straight face?
It was touch and go. And I said, oh, that's fine, whatever their wishes are.
You didn't call security.
I didn't call security. There was no security around. And then he gets out this, must be 3-inch... horn.
Sorry, how disappointing.
Left the word horn out of that.
A little piccolo horn.
A little piccolo. Okay. A little horn. And he goes. And so all the family look round at him, thinking, what the hell's going on? I look round because I thought he was going to do the last post or something. Anyway, it turns out he got the wrong funeral. And I knew that because when we come out, you go round the side. You go round the side. And there he was at the funeral after us going to what was obviously a hunting type community.
Maybe he's a funeral crasher. He just crashes everybody's funeral and blows his horn. So delighted to be joined by three young doctors in training, making me feel my age now. Introduce yourselves. Tell us who you are and what your role is here.
My name's Dr. Rhiannon Jones. I'm a F2 junior doctor in general surgery.
F2, that will confuse people. What does that
mean? So that is our second year foundation training out of university.
Okay, and who have we got in the middle?
My name's Dr. Catherine Hubbard. I graduated last year, so I'm in my foundation year one training year. Also in general surgery, I'm moving on to my F2 year in just a couple of weeks' time.
So you're a year behind Rhiannon?
Yes.
And what are you going to be doing in your next job?
My next job's in psychiatry, which I'm actually quite excited for.
So from general surgery to psychiatry?
Yeah.
Wow, that's a bit of a change.
Yeah, but it's an exciting one. It's something I've considered as a future career, so...
Good. Well, we need psychiatrists. And who have we got here on the end?
My name is Anushka Shah. I'm starting my foundation year one training today.
Today?
Yes. So
gosh.
It's my first day on the job. And it's we have like 10 days of shadowing before we start the actual job. So
and how are you feeling about it? First day on the job, are they looking after you?
They're lovely.
It's like Russian dolls. We have you at three different stages of your career.
Yeah, so I'm quite excited to start. I'm also on general surgery, so.
Isn't it interesting how they phase you in? So in my day, old fart speaking, I qualified in 1987. August 1st used to be known as the killing season. The joke was that the junior docs would all start on the same day. None of them were particularly well trained, and we were just left alone to see one, do one, teach one, have a go first before you ask for help. And then people realised that was actually quite dangerous. And now we induce people. So you've had a little bit of induction.
Yeah.
You're the most senior one here, Rhiannon. How do you survive in the NHS and enjoy your job? What are your top tips?
Top tips are be organised.
Okay.
Get to know all the nurses, all the healthcare assistants, the cleaners, everyone like that, because they're so helpful.
So be humble and ask for help.
Definitely.
Admit when you don't know someone.
100%.
It was lovely actually meeting. I met here a junior doctor on her first day. Isn't that extraordinary? So when I trained, August the 1st was known as the killing season, when all the new junior doctors came on and they were all fumble fingers and butterfingers and didn't know what they were doing. And this lovely junior doctor said, no, these days you have an induction. So she was being induced by the person the year above her, who was being trained by the person a year above her. And they had a lovely induction, so it was all rather gentle. I never had any of that. Mine was far more brutal. Went to university and the first patient I met was a dead one. Start as you mean to go on. We did dissection, and that was like, it's like a rites of passage thing with doctors. You know, you're going to go in, you're going to cut up a dead body. And we had this really, really scary professor of anatomy, and we were in a small group, and we had this dead body, this cadaver. And he said, there are two things you need to know to survive in medicine. The first you need to learn is to be disgusted by nothing. And he pops his finger up the corpse's bottom and he pops it in his mouth. Disgusting. And then he says, your turn. First day at medical school, we're thinking, well, this is a bit iffy, isn't it? Because, you know, here's the bloke who's going to be giving my anatomy viva at the end of the term. Don't really want to accept it. So very, very tamely, like sheep, we all popped the finger in and popped it in the mouth. I have to say, it didn't taste pooey. I mean, it wasn't the nicest thing in the world. It was a little bit chemically, but I thought, oh, no, I can live with that. And we've all done it. And then the bugger says, this is true. And he said, yes. The second thing you need to learn to survive in medicine is observation. Yeah. The observant ones will have noticed I put this finger up the arse and the second finger in my mouth. Index middle, that old trick.
Hi, I'm Balon Kamalarajan. I'm one of the consultant paediatricians and I'm also the lead for our shared care oncology unit.
How do you cope with being a parent, being a dad? Because some people who work in peds, you know, they see what can happen to other people's kids, and then they go home and be a parent, and it freaks them out slightly. Are you able to divorce those two?
I'm okay. Probably a very unsympathetic parent because my children, fortunately, are generally very well. So,
doctors often make dreadful parents, though, don't they? Your kid can have sepsis, and you're just saying, "Oh, just pull yourself together. It's just a bit of a bug."
I hope I wouldn't go that far. It takes a lot for them to end up in hospital. Okay. Breaking the bad news, having become a parent, though during the consultation itself I'm able to keep my professional face and everything else, I often go away and it hurts a bit more.
And you provided a lovely young person for us to talk to. Introduce us. Who have you?
So this is one of our patients. She's Molly.
Hi, Molly. Tell us why you're standing in this hospital playground now.
I'm just here for a checkup.
Okay.
I was diagnosed back in 2018.
With what?
Acute lymphoblastic leukemia.
How old were you?
I was 13.
Okay.
I remember my mum being very upset about it. She was very much in disbelief, but I think I just took it in my stride, to be honest with you. I was very calm at the start. I think a lot calmer than mum, to be honest.
What was the thing you found hardest?
Not knowing how I was going to react to the chemotherapy. That's because it's different for everyone.
Yep. And what side effects did you have?
I was bedbound. I couldn't walk very well. Very nauseous. Very tired. Would sleep the day off, really.
What about your hair? Did anything happen to your hair?
Yeah, I had 30-inch locks and I lost them all.
Because hair is really important to people, isn't it?
It was my safety blanket, my hair. I did love it, but the minute I found out I was going to lose it, I said I'm going to donate it to the Little Princess Trust. Yeah, what? I put them in plaits and I cut them all off and...
Oh my word.
...donated them all.
So what happens to the hair that's donated?
It's made into wigs for children that lose their hair. I did actually have a wig off the Little Princess Trust and I didn't wear it as much as a lot of other kids do because I like the bold look, but...
Okay.
Yeah.
And your hair's growing back now?
Yeah.
It's looking great. Looks really good.
Thank you.
My name's David Chamberlain. I'm the Library and Knowledge Services Manager for
Library
the Trust.
And Knowledge Services Manager.
That's right,
that
yes.
That sounds like a bit of wonk. What does it actually involve?
It involves running the library services, training all the doctors, nurses, all the staff to finding quality information.
That's really important, isn't it? Because they used to say it can take up to 10 years for a new bit of evidence to reach the front line. You're managing to speed that up a bit, are you?
Yeah, we're using traditional and also virtual services.
Reading and stories are really important, A, to your mental health and particularly to help you escape when you're ill.
You're talking about bibliotherapy, and that's okay. Something I'm absolutely...
Bibliotherapy? Yeah. There's an actual term for
there's
it?
There's a term okay. for it. I absolutely love it. Reading for health.
Okay.
So I've been doing poetry groups. So for the Health and Care Trust, I've gone on to psychiatric wards. I've written up a little piece of research about this as well, about the benefits of reading aloud. So we'll do a group session, just reading a poem, and anyone can read that poem or a verse or one line. And then we just discuss it.
What is it about it? Is it the poem itself, the fact that they're reading it out loud, they're having a chat to understand it, or all three?
Well, in this research, and it's in the Journal of Poetry Therapy.
There is a Journal of Poetry Therapy. Are you sure you're not making this up?
There's a Journal of Poetry Therapy. Okay. I've got two articles in there. Because I wanted to see, is reading aloud, is this group different to a knit and natter group?
Okay.
Or to a gardening group? Or is it just a group therapy, or is it group processes that are helping people? And I found it was actually the reading aloud, so the confidence, building that confidence up to read aloud, and then the support for other people to do that as well. So it was like the sharing and encouragement.
So there was an added benefit to just nattering?
Yeah, okay. Added benefit.
Who knows that Worcestershire has its own poet laureate? Who heard of that? Who knows that?
Yes.
Anyone got any idea who the poet laureate of Worcestershire is? Big round of applause for Aid. Let's have Aid up on stage. Up you come, Aid. Tell us a little bit about yourself first. So what's your connection with this hospital and helping people?
I used to manage a service here which provided volunteers to go around the ward and basically spend time with people who were living with dementia who were in the hospital for reasons other than their dementia. And just imagine, if you don't know quite where you are or why you're in this place, just try and think how terrifying that could be for somebody.
So tell us what the poem's called that you're going to read for us.
Okay, this is called Made of Stories, and I wrote this to remind people that behind the diagnosis of dementia, everybody has a story to tell. All the references I'm making here are to people I've worked with, nearly all of them in this hospital. This is called Made of Stories. The old squaddy had met Elvis and had the photo with him still. The woman stood at the bus stop who was an extra in the bill. The lonely old guy in his flat, post left her notice on the map. Memory waning, feeling bored. He'd helped design Concord. The next door neighbour, quiet, shy. He'd helped the Thunderbirds to fly. The old man nearing end of life mistakes his daughter for his wife. The wartime pilot, all alone now, if given chance, he'll tell you how, as well as fighting for the nation, he'd been a guard at the coronation. Everyone has a tale to tell. Some are exquisite, some are hell. Times and places that they have been, who they've met, what they've seen. Some tales too horrific to share. Most ignored by those who just don't care. But listen, if you can, please. Because we're all made of stories. Thank you.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. Isn't that lovely? Thank you very much indeed.
I'm Dr. Phil. Nice to meet you. I'm doing a show for Radio 4 about this wonderful hospital.
Okay.
Not just talking to the staff, but people who are using it. You look as if you're using the hospital at the moment.
I've been here a while, yes.
Tell us who you are and why you're here.
Darren Oliver. I've had a diabetic ulcer that infected the heel bone. I came in to have lava treatment.
A lava treatment? Yeah, they put maggots.
Maggots on, yeah.
Did that surprise you? Did you think, gosh, are they...
I've heard of it. Obviously, I've done a bit of research before I came in.
So when it was first mentioned to you, did you think, oh, gosh, that sounds a bit medieval, using maggots?
Well, it is. It's been since Victorian times, but apparently it's the best treatment they've still got.
Gosh.
They don't get them from the local fishing tackle shop. Apparently they're grown in a farm in Wales.
Okay.
They come in like a little tea bag.
Okay.
And they attach them to the wound. And they leave them, they change, they have to be soaked every day. So they take the dress off, they soak this tea bag in a little bit of water, put it back on, dress you up, strap it up.
And can you feel anything? I know you have less sensation when you have diabetes anyway, but could you feel it at all?
Not at all. I thought, I'm not going to like that. But okay. I just really do not. And they're tiny. When they first attach them, you can hardly see them. And then, obviously, after 4 days, it's usually a 4 or 5 day cycle they leave them on for. And when they take them off after 5 days, you can see they've done their job because they're quite fat, like, you know, a bit like me.
They feasted on you.
Well, after they feasted on me, they came out obese. So.
£2.80 change, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
God bless you.
Thank you.
Have a nice day. Thank you.
So, introduce yourself, Paul. What are you doing here?
Oh, yeah, my name's Paul. Just fruit store, basically, outside the hospital. Been here for about 4 years now. We've got 4 different types of apples, conference pears, pineapples, melons, strawberries, raspberries, blueberries, green grapes, red grapes, nectarines, cherries, all your salads, lettuce, cucumber, spring onion, your veg, everything.
You've got a large cucumber for a pound. That could end up in the emergency department if you're not careful. Got your radishes. Gosh, you've got everything, haven't you?
Yeah.
I think it's a brilliant idea because I've been in so many hospitals and the first thing you see is your Mars bars and your curly whirlies when you go in there.
Yeah.
And it's a friend of mine is a cardiologist and he was putting a stent in somebody's heart, saving his life. And then they served him sausage and chips afterwards. And he said, you're just feeding me the food that's put me in here in the first place. So there's a big need to do this.
I'm Tony Newman. I'm a porter here at Worcester Royal. I've been here since 2002.
19
and a half years.
So your smile, you're the most well-known face and personality in the hospital, let me think.
Probably one of the most famous, I would say, yeah.
Why have you worked here so long? What's made you want to stick at this job?
I just enjoy my job. Okay. To be fair, I was a greengrocer before I came here.
Okay.
So it was completely different to what I used to do.
Are you responsible for the grocers out the front of the hospital?
No,
you get in there and there's fruit and veg is the first thing you see.
I know, he did say that, you had a chat with him.
Banter is crucial for the work of a porter, isn't it?
Do you know something? One of the most important things in my eyes when you're actually transporting a patient from A to B is making that patient feel comfortable. A lot of patients can be frightened and don't know what to expect, so you make them feel comfortable and at ease and you just try and have general chit-chat with them.
We're also talking a little bit about death in this program, although it's a comedy program, and I'm interested, how do you prepare your porter? So sometimes you've got to go and pick up a dead body from a ward or something.
So yeah, basically, we get the call from the help desk, and they say we have a delivery to Rose Cottage. So that comes over
so
on the radio.
So that's like a euphemism, you know that's a death.
Yeah, so yes, they say a delivery to Rose Cottage.
David Nicholson, I'm the chair of Worcester Acute Hospitals NHS Trust.
Tell us a bit about yourself. So you're a Nottingham boy, born and bred.
Yes.
And a Nottingham Forest supporter, lifelong.
That's right.
So you remember Clough and Peter Taylor and all that lot?
I do. I remember all of that.
Okay. Is it true that when you were interviewed for Chief Executive of the NHS, they said to you, if you were a dog, what dog would you be?
They did ask me that question.
Really? To be Chief Executive of the NHS?
They really asked me that question.
And what dog did you say?
I didn't. I said I didn't want to play their silly
game. Did you say that's a stupid game and I'm not doing it?
That's exactly what I said. I was the only NHS person on the list.
Who were you up against?
I was up against two American healthcare experts. In fact, my was
well,
both of them came in their own jets. Okay. I was very disappointed I came on a bus, but they came in a jet. I was Chief Executive, 4 years Labour and 4 years Tory.
Did you have a preference?
So Labour. So
you were previously a member of the Communist Party, is that true?
I was a member of the Communist Party.
Right,
okay, well, the thing about the Communist Party thing was when I first got the job, they set out a whole load of journalists to interview me. I'd never been interviewed by national journalists. I didn't know how hideous they were. The journalist said to me at the end of the interview, David, tell me something that nobody else knows about. Oh, yeah, I was a member of the Communist Party. So,
had you heard of media skills training at that stage, David?
No, was something new. From Doncaster. We were used to telling it as it was.
And that was then front page, was it?
It got
Daily
front page,
Mail.
Got front page.
Commie in charge of the NHS.
Absolutely got front page.
I've loved it here, and I mean, it's difficult judging the quality just by going around and chatting to people, but there are people here who worked here for years, whole families who work here. The vibe here is fine. What needed turning around when you got here? What were they struggling with?
It's a fantastic hospital.
Okay.
And the people are great. If I go to other hospitals, people normally start off by telling me about the wonderful things that they do.
Yeah.
Here, they tend to start talking about the things that they don't do very well. And it's in
they've had too many Care Quality Commission inspections in that case.
They've absolutely have.
Yeah, yeah.
And it hollowed the organisation out. It lost its way in all of this.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it was described to me as learned helplessness.
Okay.
But basically another group of people will come along and point out all the weaknesses of the organisation. So the most important thing is to start build on the things that we do really well.
I've always used laughter as a way of coping, and lots of doctors who go into comedy give up the day job. I generally haven't, because I need the material, but also because it just makes me laugh. And sometimes it is inappropriate. So before we go to the song, I'll just share the true story. It was a lovely old woman who came into the emergency department bleeding from the back end. And those of you who have trained in medicine know that you try often assume something is due to hemorrhoids, but it might be something more serious. And the surgeons always say, if you don't put your finger in it, you'll put your foot in it. And this lady was a little bit confused, but I had to explain that I was going to have to do pop a finger in the back end, and I did my best consent, and I thought I was just about there, and I put my glove on and put some jelly on and very, very gently popped a finger in the back end. She lifted her head off the pillow and she said, "Is that you, George?" And that stuff just happens in medicine sometimes, and should we laugh, should we not laugh? I don't know. That's the answer. I don't know whether it's appropriate or not.
Hi, I'm Anna Sturks. I am the Head of Patient Care and Public Engagement. A very long title.
That is a very big badge you've got there.
It is Patient Experience and Patient Engagement. Okay. Patients, carers and their family and friends, what they think about our hospitals and then doing something about it. And then on the other side, engaging with people in their own healthcare. So not making decisions about people without including them in those decisions.
No decision about me without me is something exactly. We keep parroting, but you're actually trying to make it work.
Yeah, it was a new job role when I came in. I'm from outside the NHS.
What did you do beforehand?
I worked for the British Youth Council, sort of youth empowerment, youth democracy and youth leadership. And I led UK Youth Parliament nationally as well.
Gosh, so you're a big boon to this hospital.
I have energy.
Do you have... oh, they're all laughing now. I have energy. Are you known to be very energetic?
I am.
Yeah. We need some energy. Yeah. Let's get Anna along.
And I like to make a difference.
Okay. As well as having energy, you appear to have a lovely smile and a great laugh.
Thank you.
Are you someone who thinks humour is important in your role?
Very important. Smiling and working together is really important. To be greeted by a smile makes a massive difference.
I used to teach communication skills to medical students in Birmingham, actually, and Bristol. And somebody suggested we should do a course called Acting Skills for Doctors, because sometimes doctors are a bit knackered and sometimes they'd rather go to bed than get out of bed and sort out the next admission. But the trouble is that if it isn't felt authentically, it looks as if you're putting on. It's a bit how to win friends and influence people. So actually what you want to do is recruit kind people who are genuinely smiling rather than robots who are putting on a false smile. Would that be fair?
Yeah, it would. And to show people that we are people and we're personable and we're human.
I don't know why I did this. I read Anna's CV. So Anna does amazing stuff with patient engagement. And then it said on her CV that she did lots of theatricals and performing. So I just said for a joke, shall we sing Papa Does Mambo by Perry Como? Never sung it before, and neither of you have. And that had never played it before, and now we're going to completely murder it. But we did do one rehearsal, and we figured out that Anna is actually a much better singer than I am. So there are slight ego issues going on here. Papa loves mambo.
Mama loves mambo. Look at him play with it, getting so gay with it, shouting ole with it, yeah.
Papa loves mambo.
Do you have any acting training?
Yes. In a past life.
In a past life that you don't want to be reminded of? What was your biggest role? What did you do?
I did the Edinburgh International Festival.
What did you do?
I was in Les Petits Rats, which was with Jude Law, actually, and lots of other people who went on to become really famous. Make of that as you will.
Does Jude work as a volunteer here now? Would he? I bet you would if he asked.
But
when this goes out, I'll bet you 50p Jude Law phones you up and says, "Lovely to hear you again, Anna. I'm coming to work as a volunteer."
Maybe.
Never fails, Radio 4.
I've got a blue Peter badge as well off the back of that.
Okay.
Could have worn it.
I think you should be singing on the wards. I'm going to come here as your music therapist.
We have been looking into music therapy, yeah.
I'll come and do a guest slot. I'm sort of mid-range Frank Sinatra. I can't take it up
the
octave.
We
could.
Don't let her rumble and don't let her samba, cause Papa loves the mambo tonight.
Thank you, folks. Thank you, thank you. It's been an absolute delight. Apologise to the late Perry Como for murdering perhaps one of his greatest hits. It's been an absolute joy. Thank you for inviting me to your lovely hospital. Go gently into that good night.